This is Let's Go Michigan with Jeff Sloan on 760 WJR. Your bird's eye view on Michigan's business and entertainment scene. Here's Jeff.
All right, welcome to Let's Go Michigan. Kristen Kajawa, Mark Pastoria here with me. Guys, I've been reading a lot lately about various applications of AI, artificial intelligence. And of course, I don't know about you, but we knew it was going to get weird.
Yeah.
Of course.
Sure.
It was either going to get, it was maybe even worse than weird. It could have gotten dangerous, gets into the wrong hands.
Right.
It's a powerful tool, could be threatening, could be disturbing. And I got to tell you, I read a couple of articles this week about AI, and I just thought we'd highlight it. You know, we try to bring in this opening segment of our show news and information that may be interesting, stimulating, you know, sometimes relevant to state of Michigan, but sometimes just relevant to all of us, regardless of where we're from or where we're based. And it just occurred to me this week in reading some of these new applications that have been announced for AI, we've gotten into the disturbing phase very least.
Okay.
So the first article that I read was titled, "Scientist Claims His AI Can Tell Disturbing Things About You Just by Looking at Your Face." Your face can show stress or distress or whatever it may be, happiness, obviously. And so this AI package, this powerful software program, essentially, is able to pick up on cues in your face just by looking at your face and determining a lot about you, a lot about how you're feeling, a lot about who you are, a lot about how you think, and so on and so on. This is a Stanford psychologist named Michael Kaczynski. He claims that the AI capability that he's built detects not only all of the things that I just mentioned, but also your level of intelligence, your sexual preferences, political leanings, and with a great degree of accuracy, just by scanning your face.
Seriously.
Look out.
It's time for a mask mandate again.
Yeah.
Look out. I'm telling you, it gets weirder by the day. Now, of course, you know, human beings have a certain ability to determine certain things. Like, I can tell if, like Kristen, we know each other well, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell if you're stressed. I know when you are. I can tell if you're feeling a little run down.
Mm-hmm.
But this is able, not only just a stranger, but a bot, in effect now, an algorithm, can look at your face and determine your sexual preference, your, you know, all these other things
political,
that I just mentioned, intelligence, political leanings, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Wow.
We're not ready for this, are we?
I don't know, but you better get ready.
I guess so.
Because I think this is just the start of these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, maybe there's a place in the world for something like this that could be very, very positive in its use.
Yeah, let's not assume that it's going to be bad.
That's
there could be something positive from this.
There could be, like, give us an example, Krista.
I can't right now, but...
Yeah, right?
You know, we always worry about, you know, in general... society, as a society, as people, we worry about people looking over our shoulders as it is, but this has taken it a lot further. This just not only picks up the tape by comparison to these video cameras, but this makes interpretation out of it.
Yeah.
And it could be used to make judgments that God knows where this could have application and where judgments could be made that could be right or wrong.
Right.
But they're going to be making judgments about you.
Just going to be walking around with a ski mask on now, I guess.
Yes, we could actually learn things about you that I'm frankly not even sure we want to know.
Gotcha.
So here we go.
The
power of AI. Well, I've got another one.
Oh, more?
Yes, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it's not the end of the story. There's another AI app that I learned about this past week that allows you to create basically a clone of yourself in digital form. So this AI application will basically, I mean figuratively, follow you around, pick up on everything you do, the way you think, the way you react to certain things, and, you know, preferences and all the rest, everything about you that makes you you. It will begin to record this data and in effect then become a digital clone of you. Now, the way it's positioned, what could this be used for? Well, the inventor, this is Felix Tao, a software engineer, research assistant. He's the CEO of Mindverse. Here's what he has to say. Everyone deserves an AI that's defined by them, not by Big Brother. He says, after he and his team launched MeBot, an AI assistant that learns and develops alongside you, a digital clone of you. Now, why would I want this? That begs the first question, why? Well, let's find out. Going deeper into the story, he says it's designed to be a personalized life coach and companion that evolves through your thoughts and ideas. At its most basic, MeBot can help you with all of your daily tasks. You can drop in things like your to-dos and meeting schedule, and it will provide context and reminders as deadlines loom. You can interact with the MeBot by voice, text, image, and links. It will respond thinking the way you tend to think. The last thing I want is an opinion from me. That's the last thing I want. I don't know about you guys.
But I love this.
Really?
As a mom, I could absolutely use a clone of me.
Yeah, like you could just send the bot out there when your kids late at night want to have a dessert.
Send in the clones.
There you go. Good one, Mark Pastoria. Send in the clones. I like that. That's good. So you like it, Kristen?
Well, I think. But, I mean, I'm not that great.
I think it makes a statement about you that you like it, because I do think it takes a certain kind of person that wants to have
a clone of themselves. I just want help. That's all I want.
Yeah.
I don't want me 2.0.
Right. Now you
unless
know,
she's
you
better
know.
Than me.
So there you go. Lots of interesting developments in the AI world.
Wow.
There you go. Now listen, I thought we'd end this first segment on a lighter note, if you will. It is the weekend after all.
Mm-hmm.
So I did pick up on another story that has nothing to do with any of this heady kind of stuff, like AI and bots and all the clones and all the rest of it. This is simply, frankly, a story that I thought you guys might know a thing or two about. The most popular cocktail in every state in 2024, according to Google search data.
Here we go.
It is the weekend.
All right, I said,
Saturday content, perfectly fitting. When it comes down to the most popular cocktails, we're all about refreshing and zesty sips right now. That seems to be the leading preference for drinks in general. So let's do it by cocktail version. That's the way it's broken down in the article we found, by the way, in Real Simple, providing this list. Aperol Spritz, kind of a fancy drink, uses the aperitif Aperol, and that's the cocktail most preferred by most states right now. In fact, it's favored in 21 states and the District of Columbia as the favorite drink. This includes Arizona, California, Colorado, and oh, by the way, Michigan. In Michigan, it's the Aperol Spritz that takes number one when it comes to a favorite cocktail. Well, how about the good old margarita? That's always a classic. That comes in at number two, favored by 17 states as the favorite cocktail, including states like Georgia, Indiana, Kansas, Maine, Mississippi. It's a classic. And then number three, any guesses? Number three, what are some popular cocktails?
Martini.
Let's see. Martini is not, you know.
Wasn't even on the list.
Not in the top 10.
Oh.
Of the most popular. Coming in at number three, it's actually a drink that from time to time when we finish our work on a winter day here in the studio and we say, you know, maybe let's have one.
Old fashioned?
There you go.
It's nice.
The old fashioned, preferred in states like Alaska, Iowa, Kentucky, Minnesota, Montana. All these states are kind of the cold. Isn't it interesting?
That is.
These are colder states because it's darker liquor, more of a winter style, colder climate.
Kentucky makes sense. The whiskey comes from
there. Right, there you go. All right, number four. Moscow Mule.
Yeah, right.
States like Wyoming, Idaho, Montana, Utah love their Moscow Mules. So there you have it.
Wow.
Most popular cocktails.
That's fun.
It was fun.
Yeah.
So I would say this, if you're worried about AI, have a cocktail.
Yes, that's good to me.
And forget about it. So there's a change happening in the world of labor and business, and certainly if that all ultimately trickles down to affecting consumers, and that is the change to this new ruling to the minimum wage requirement starting in, it looks like, February of 2025. The minimum wage is going to change from roughly $10.33 an hour to slightly over $12 an hour next year and continue to rise through 2028, depending on inflation calculations made by the state. This is interesting. Of course, when this happens, those who are to be paid rejoice in hearing the news. They've got a shot to be paid a little more, but those having to do the paying, that being the businesses, and ultimately maybe even the consumers, there might be some pushback, to say the least, when it comes to having to pay more, especially, you know, here's the thing, Kristen, these business operators, in particular restaurants, bars, et cetera, they've been struggling as it is.
Absolutely.
To make a go of it. And my God, the last few years with the pandemic, all the changes in that business space in particular as a result of the pandemic, but then inflation coming on the heels in the post-pandemic period, and now seemingly starting to get out of that big challenge, but now having to face more costs of operating their business, more labor costs as a result of the change to the minimum wage. Well, we're going to learn more about this. We're going to hear from Paula Gardner, who's just published an article in Bridge, Michigan. She's a business reporter at Bridge, Michigan. And as I say, she's just published an article, What to Know about Michigan's pending minimum wage changes. Paula, you're here to bring us the story. Thanks for joining us. Good to have you on.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Paula, at a high level, tell us what the ruling provides, both for workers and maybe how it affects businesses as well.
So minimum wage now will go from $10.33 per hour, likely to about $12 an hour next year. And that's speculation. It's like informed speculation. But the ruling is tying the minimum wage to the rate of inflation now. And because they're kind of going back to 2018, when all of this started with a ballot proposal that the legislature adopted, they're still figuring out the actual rate.
Okay. And so this is tied to a change in the tip minimum wage, as you alluded to as well. And that was for the tip minimum wage actually required $3.93 per hour. And now what's happening with that?
That will be phased out over 4 years. Anybody who was earning the tipped minimum wage now will get the single minimum wage, the overall number that is the minimum that employers can pay their employees in Michigan.
And so obviously those on the labor side of this equation are going to be thrilled with the change, right? They're going to make more per hour now at a minimum. So that's good. The tip minimum wage then applies to restaurant and bar workers. Is that right, Paula?
If that's what the employer worked out with them. So servers and bartenders are the more frequent tipped minimum wage employees in Michigan.
But there's a lot of other people that are relying on minimum wage payment, and they don't qualify under the tip minimum wage circumstance. So they are going to be thrilled with the fact that there's now a higher minimum across the board.
Yeah, there aren't that many workers. I think it's something around 5%. And I may be getting that wrong, but that's kind of the essence of it, that there aren't that many minimum wage workers in Michigan at this point. But yeah, everybody is getting a raise. And it seems like, you know, once you start raising the bottom, you know, that rising tide lifts all boats.
Sure.
And wages could go up across the board. But servers across the state have been divided on this issue. Many of them supported the tipped minimum because it allowed them to, they believe, earn more based on their tips, based on their work, which is, you know, hard, and also based on the type of establishment where they work, you know, some of the higher end restaurants or places where there's a high volume and a high tip.
And so break down for me how the tip minimum wage works. You have a certain minimum.
Yeah. So if I'm a server in a restaurant, typically I would make $3.93 per hour, and the establishment would have to pay me minimum wage, except they use something called like the tip credit. So there's this understanding that there's tips that are closing that gap and possibly exceeding it. There are some tipped employees who would be making more than that minimum wage. I think bartenders are probably the most frequent. You know, they may be making $5 or $6 per hour, but they still kind of fit into that lower minimum wage because of the tip credit. The tips are expected to make up the bulk of their income.
Right. Let me say that, you know, on the one hand, those that are going to benefit from this, those doing the work and getting paid the minimum wage benefit from this, but there's a lot in the business sector that are really concerned, even many calling it devastating. It could literally cause certain businesses to shutter their doors. What have you learned about that? And how real is that threat to businesses?
I think they're all sorting it out right now, but the Michigan Restaurant and Lodging Association did a study earlier this year, and they told me that they were surprised by the results, that anecdotally, they had a sense that restaurants were not uniformly performing well across the state. And what they learned is that 40% of the people who were surveyed, the operators, said that they were not profitable, which is actually pretty stunning when you think that almost half of Michigan's restaurants are not making money. Although many of the people who responded to that survey were also independent operators. So those are the people who might have 1, 2, 10 restaurants. They're not the chains. And we're seeing symptoms of this, though, in the chains, such as the Red Lobster bankruptcy filing. You know, that's a symptom of it, too. But 20% of these restaurant operators who were surveyed also say that they would possibly close if what happened, if this ruling did come about. And part of it is so much of the unknown about their increases, because they will have to pay their employees more. They are saying that they will have to raise menu rates to cover it. And we've all seen restaurant prices go up, particularly since the pandemic. Inflation was a real problem for restaurants, along with the availability of certain types of goods. So they're saying they could be raising their prices by 25%. I think there's a huge question mark if a restaurant has to do that.
Right.
How does the customer react?
Exactly.
Now that we know that the tipped worker is making at least minimum wage. You know, a lot of people during the years waiting for this decision talked about going to Europe and how you could leave a few euros on the table and everybody was happy because the servers earned a living wage and they didn't count on tips for so much. So I think it's fair to ask, culturally, will we still get restaurant bills with the automatic 20% tip option or 25% or even higher? Because I think people also became much more generous over the last few years.
Yeah, but they're also really inflation weary. And I think the question about whether consumers are going to tolerate this or not is exactly the right point. It'll be interesting. And businesses can't survive having to pay 20, 25% more in cost to operate, but yet, you know, not pass along those additional costs to the customer. And again, will they tolerate it? It'll be interesting to see. This takes effect in 2025, right?
Yes, early next year. There's kind of a grace period. And the restaurant industry is hoping that legislators will change the rules in the interim. And I think there's a lot of lobbying going on. But there are also legislators who say this is a good thing for workers and they have no incentive to change it. So I think, you know, the kind of the tension and the pressure is going to stay with this decision for a long time. So I talk to the restaurant industry and I just kind of feel the tension for them. And I always try to underscore something for the workers too, because I think that's an unknown.
Okay. We'll be counting on you, Paula, to bring us the updates as you get them, should there be any, with respect to this ruling actually going into effect beginning in 2025. We appreciate you bringing the story to us, Paula. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Paula Gardner, business reporter at Bridge Michigan. Thanks for bringing us that important story. It will affect everyone in business. Now, we're going to enter into territory here with the next interview that we're going to bring you that could be considered a little bit of dangerous territory, especially for those of us maybe that own and operate a business, maybe for parents, maybe even those of us who strive for perfection all the time. Know anybody like that?
I'm looking no one right
like
at
that,
him.
No one like that around here, right?
None of these parts.
Well, listen, for those of us like that, and frankly, we've kind of been shaped, most of us, frankly, in various ways to really push hard to be the best versions of ourselves all the time and to go hard all the time to try to achieve just that. Kristen, before we jump into the interview, I want to ask, did you check your checklist and make sure we got all the EQ right on the sound check and we got the script just right? You delivered me my folder with all of my notes in it for the interview. You got all that done?
No, Jeff. No.
What do you mean no? You do that way every time.
I know.
You know what's expected.
I understand. However, yes? After reading this article, which I brought to your attention, mind you, average is the way to go. And I'm going to be practicing that from now on.
Yes, I knew when this subject matter came up that I should
I am taking summarily this to heart. Yeah.
Cut it out as we're not even covering this, Kristen. But in any case, we've let the cat out of the bag.
Yeah.
And the reality is, as you've just alluded to, we're going to bring you a story right now. The headline of the article published by Emily Stewart in Business Insider is "Stop Trying to Optimize Everything. The Key to Happiness is Being Average." Really? That sounds stressful to me.
It sounds so stressful. I got to agree with
okay.
you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's open our minds and let's try to figure it out. Emily Stewart, welcome. Tell us about this. Is that for real? Is it really a key to happiness to stop trying to pursue to be the best at everything all the time?
Yeah. I mean, I do think a lot of people have that feeling, myself included, that you have to kind of always be sprinting, always be trying, always maybe not be the best, but be as close to the best as possible. And obviously this is not true for everyone in every area. It feels sort of like the situation where sometimes when you're constantly sprinting, you're not necessarily happy. You know, I talked to one person for this story who kind of talked about this in the context of jeans. And maybe, you know, decades ago, you had maybe two options of jeans, right? You get X or Y and you're fine.
Right.
But now you have 200 and suddenly you feel like there's this pressure of like, well, which one is the best? And it also feels like those jeans say something about you, right? Maybe you care about the environment. Maybe you want to look cool. Maybe you don't care what you look like. And so it does wind up in a situation where we're really focusing on finding the best and it's not necessarily making our lives better.
Yeah. And yet there's so much pressure to do just that. This kind of, it's so counterintuitive. And it goes against the grain to think that we should accept, that's a good way to say it, just that we should accept being mediocre or being average at a certain given thing or just generally as we live out our lives. Especially difficult for those of us that are always striving, I don't know about being the best, but certainly at least to be our best, the best version of ourselves. And that creates a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress, And frankly, when you talk about quality of life, perhaps a decay in that quality of life because we just can't let down.
Well, and Jeff, everybody has a different version of success, right? The bar is set different for everybody. So when we think about the pressure that we're putting on ourselves, but also we're feeling it because it's cultural. We're also feeling it because of the social media that we ingest all day long. So it's coming at us in all directions, really.
Yeah, I mean, some of this is sort of, you know, a reflection of kind of mature capitalism. So you think, you know, years and years ago, really, it was a situation where your boss was saying, go, 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 go. But now we've really internalized that, right? You know, one person I talked to kind of said it's like, you know, we are cracking the whip on ourselves, that we feel this way. And I think that's important to think about and wonder about, why do we feel this way? And you know, it is tricky to avoid that. And I think, you know, as much as it's easy for me kind of sit and say, oh, it's fine just to be average. People feel this way for a reason. You know, we live in a really unequal society. And it is really scary to think that you might fall down the ladder. And there is a sense of scarcity. People aren't wrong to think that they have to work really, really hard to be able to afford a home and even groceries and just the necessities of life. People aren't crazy for feeling this way.
You know, we've kind of been talking about this in the context of ourselves as individuals and how this impacts this culture and this notion of otherwise trying to be your best, always striving to be your best and do your best. But there's a broader potential implication here, and that is if everyone stops pushing as hard as we're all stopping, I mean, that's where really amazing things come from. Great innovation, great ideas, great creativity typically comes from those, and in certain cases when people are pushing to the extreme, right? And if we all stop doing that, what's the broader implication about what it means for society going forward?
I mean, obviously, this situation where we all feel like we have to sprint is really good for the economy. It's really good for capitalism, right? It's also great, again, for cultivating creativity and innovation, like you said. You look at Taylor Swift, right, who's like killing it on the Eras Tour. But we also have the Olympics, and athletes are constantly breaking records, and we're constantly seeing these new medical and technological innovations.
Yep.
There is a limit there. And, you know, one person I talked to said this kind of also creates these wildly unequal societies. That's incredible for Taylor Swift that she's doing so well, but maybe there's less room for other performers to get noticed. You know, I don't think the point is everybody just sit at home and be a couch potato.
Sure.
But there is a moment to kind of reflect and say, is this necessary? If I put in an 80-hour work week, what sacrifice am I making? And is that a worthwhile sacrifice for the sake of the economy and my boss and the profits wherever I work?
So if we are buying into this and I'm going to tell myself, okay, it's okay to be average, how do we make our brains understand that? What are the steps I need to take to be okay with being average or calming down, really?
Yeah, so one tip I got during this was to practice settling, basically. And I'm not saying marry the first man you meet on the street or, you know, tell your kids drop out of school. But if you find yourself kind of standing in the grocery aisle for 10 minutes agonizing over which dish soap is maybe the best bang for your buck, like, that's a waste of time. You don't need to do that. Or, you know, in my own life, I think a lot about, you know, when you decide, let's say I'm going to go to dinner and suddenly you find yourself on Yelp 2 hours later, trying to find the perfect restaurant, or even you're on the street and you're walking by different restaurants and you realize you've passed 20 that are probably fine to get to the best one, you know, maybe just stop at the first one and it will be okay. And I think the more you practice settling a little bit, it maybe at first it feels a little bit strange, but we settle for things that aren't the best all of the time in a variety of areas, and maybe just be a little bit more conscious of that and say, you know what, it's okay if I'm visiting a city and I do not have the most optimal Instagrammable experience, that I just kind of have an okay vacation, and maybe in not stressing, I wind up having a better time.
Yeah, and maybe you don't need to publish all that and show it off on Instagram. You know, maybe it's not necessary to do that and try to keep up with the Joneses or one up the Joneses, even more to the point.
But it is good food for thought. I think we all could just calm down.
I think we just learned that it's actually a good way to maybe be more happy.
Yeah.
And maybe it's even the key to happiness. Emily Stewart, thanks for bringing us this story. Really enlightening, really amazing. We're going to take it to heart.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for being on. Listen, guys, Mark, you've already done it. You've gotten through it successfully. I'm in the process of doing it. Kristen, you're going to be doing it in a few years. What we're talking about, sending our kids to college and paying their tuition.
I have my paper and pencil all ready to go to take notes.
On the next interview, we're covering a story that, in fact, when you see a published college tuition amount that they've referenced, that is the cost of going to a particular college or university, that may not be the case, but it's incumbent upon you to know how to find out, well, what do I need to pay and how you can work it to figure out how and what to pay.
It's almost like the idea of the sticker price on a car, right?
Oh.
I mean, is it really the price? Can I haggle it down?
Well, here's the thing, though. When you go in to buy a car, you kind of expect that that's, you know, you've got to get yourself all in the right mindset
right.
and everything. You've got to negotiate. You don't think of that when you're going to pay a college tuition. But listen, we've got James Murphy, Deputy Director of Higher Education Policy at Education Reform Now. He's here to tell us, buyer beware, caveat emptor, the great college pricing sham is a reality. James, tell us. What's going on here is, in fact, the college tuition amount indicated by a college, the amount you've got to pay at a high level. What's this all about? You say no.
Yeah, so the story is that figuring out how much to pay for college or how much you should pay for college is immensely difficult in America. One of the reasons for that is the way that we've decided to set up college in the United States, which is that it's mostly treated as something individuals pay for to get an individual benefit, even though there's clear indications that the benefits of people going on to college are for the broader society. Meaning that when we have a more educated populace, mm-hmm. right, people prepared to do high-level work, that benefit comes in the form of both taxes, right? So taxes that go to states and to localities and to the federal government, but it also comes with all the benefits of having higher education. Your children are better educated as a result. Your health is better as a result. There's been really great and sort of shocking research on who COVID hurt or who the opioid epidemic has hurt. And it redoundingly falls on the heads of people who do not have college education. So there's broad benefits to higher education, but the way it's priced right now is both deeply confusing and it is, let's face it, expensive.
So let's talk about that. How is it priced right now? Break it down for us.
Yeah, so I think the very first thing we need to talk about when we're talking about how much college costs is that there's really three things we have to consider. There is the sticker price of college, right? So what happens when you look at the website and it tells you what the price is? And this is where you see the numbers like $70,000, $80,000
right.
a year.
Yep.
Then there's something called net price, which is actually just simply like what people actually pay. So what do they pay after they get grants from the government and increasingly discounts from colleges in the form of merit aid? So that's a second component here. And then the third component, the trickiest one for everybody to figure out, is what it costs for a university to educate a student every single year. And so there's good news on many of those fronts, right? Recent data that came out from the College Board shows that both the sticker price, but more importantly, that net price, the price people actually pay, has, when you adjust for inflation, actually gone down in recent years. It was actually more expensive using inflation-adjusted prices to go to college in 2006 than in 2022. But the reality is it's still very expensive. So, you know, paying $20,000 for everything for, you know, say a public college in North Carolina, and I'm talking about books, housing, tuition fees, and everything like that, $20,000 is still a huge amount of money for many, many families, right? It's better than $50,000, which might be the sticker price that they think that they're going to have to pay, but $20,000 is still a lot of money.
Yeah, and of course, there's the price of a great education. Then there's paying to help your child have an on-ramp to a better earning capability down the road that helps justify the spend as well. Both of those things are important to parents, of course, and to the student. And that's kind of what you get in exchange for the price that you pay. Where does the great pricing sham happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sham part of it is that people don't know how much college is going to cost. So that's one. So how many things in life do you have to wait until the very last moment to find out the price? there are restaurants where sometimes you open the menu and there are no prices and you just feel like, oh my God, this is going to be incredibly expensive is what that tells you. With college, you don't actually know how much you're going to end up paying until way deep into the process after you've been admitted and then they put together a financial aid practice. So part of the sham is that you just simply don't know how much it's going to cost, and what it costs you might not be as much as what it costs somebody from an area like the state where the college doesn't need as many students, right? So the level of discounting that private colleges do is based on a whole range of factors that are completely opaque and people don't know about. So that's, I think, sham one. Sham two is this idea that we can maintain this situation in which the prices of college do keep going up every single year. Students are told they need to go to college in order to get a good job. And there's some truth to that. And yet, nothing is really being done to address the price of college. Nothing is being done to drive the price of college down, which is where we get into the situation of debt forgiveness. And millennials in particular feel like they've been sold a bill of goods. Go to college, get a good job, and you know, take out some debt, it's not a problem. But you have students now with $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 worth of debt, and they feel like they haven't gotten that return on the investment.
Yeah, and I see a couple of problems there. One, I'm just amazed that the price to go to a college, any given college, may or may not be necessarily the price that you ultimately pay. You tend to believe that this is not, you know, a used car sales lot or anything, you know, or an airline ticket you're trying to buy where, you know, so-and-so's paying this price and you're paying that price and so on. You would think that the price would be the price, except for, of course, if you're able to qualify for any kind of aid or assistance in any way. And that's a different thing, but still, it's all driven off the same retail price, if you will. Just for clarity, is that not the case?
No. So the vast majority of people will not pay the sticker price for college.
That's unbelievable. I never knew that.
The people who do are typically very wealthy, right? So like, you know, to bring up the college that everybody has to talk about at some point when you talk about college, at Harvard, the sticker price is about $80,000. But the average price for people who take out any kind of federal loan or get a federal grant is, I think, about $18,000. Now, there are a lot of people going to Harvard who will pay that full sticker price. And to some degree, what they're paying helps subsidize the financial aid for people who can't afford it. But once you get into the realm of most private universities and many state universities as well, they're providing a whole range of discounts. They're called merit aid. They're often called scholarships. When people get them, they feel like, oh, that you really, really want me. You're really interested in me. You think I'm super smart. But then you dig a little deeper and you find out everybody's getting a merit aid scholarship. Because the trick is, just like you mentioned a store. Why do stores give coupons? Not because they like you and they're, you know, they're really interested in you personally. They want you to come and shop there, right?
Sure, of course.
Same thing with undergraduate colleges. They discount the price in order to get you to cough up some money.
Based on what you're telling me, it sounds like if the price is $80,000 a year, one way or the other, the university that's selling the educational service, the opportunity, still gets the $80,000. It's incumbent upon those applying, those ultimately that will go to that school, to be clever enough and resourceful enough to be able to find ways to pay less than $80,000 based on programs they qualify and other opportunities to help that given student ultimately, or the parents of that given student ultimately, pay less than that price while the university still gets that price, right? It's not like the university is dropping the price for a given student. This student pays 60, that one pays 70, this one pays 75. It's still $80,000. It's just as a parent or as someone supporting themselves going to school, you've got to be resourceful enough to find ways to pay less based on programs available to you to help you do just that. Is that right?
Not exactly, actually.
Okay. I mean, we need clarification on that.
Yes, yeah.
You see? I still need help here.
Yes. Well, part of the problem, of course, is that when we talk about colleges and universities, we often end up talking about just those ones that are the top-ranked colleges in U.S. News rankings, right? So, like, the most famous institutions, which educate not even 10% of students in America. So most students are not going to the kind of place where people are really happy to cough up the full freight for tuition. Most places, the prices they set are kind of a fiction, ultimately, right? So the university is going to say, well, we'll charge $60,000 because we know then that if we can give a $25,000 discount on it, right? Because really what we need to get out of somebody is $35. We'll charge $60, we'll discount it $25 on average for people. families feel this way. I've seen this, feel like, oh my gosh, we got a scholarship. How can we say no? That's so exciting. And so they'll say like, all right, so we'll pay the 35 because we got this great scholarship. But the university essentially was always aiming for that $35,000 amount. Now, what makes it all unsustainable is that that discounting rate has gotten so widespread and so deep that you're seeing some private institutions, they simply can't pay the bills anymore.
Wow. That's stunning to me that actually one student or parents of a given student might be paying less than somebody else just because the university wanted them for whatever reason and was extending some sort of discount off the price selectively to one student versus another.
Absolutely the case.
That's incredible. That is a sham. Indeed.
Well, and, you know, for listeners, the sort of the practical advice to give on this is first, you know, when you get your financial aid offer from a college, don't treat it like it's the last offer. I mean, you do have to kind of walk into these situations like you're shopping for a car, thinking like, okay, so this is the start of the negotiation. You should not be afraid to reach out to them and say, hey, you know, my daughter's really interested in going to X college, but the price is a little bit high. We've also got this offer from this other place as well. Do you think you can take anything off? You know, some institutions will find the money, some institutions won't, but it's 100% worth trying.
You have enlightened us. This is amazing. Really, it is. Who knew? Listen, James, thanks so much for, as I say, enlightening us and bringing our awareness to the fact that the published price when it comes to paying for a great college education may not indeed be the price you need to pay.
Exactly.
Appreciate it very much, James. Thanks for being on with us.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate you having me on.
All right, Kristen, great show. Mark, Pastoria, good job as always. Thanks for putting it all together for us, making it all go. We appreciate you tuning in to Let's Go Michigan on this fine Saturday afternoon here in the Great Lakes State, the great state of Michigan. See you next weekend.